Welcome, welcome, welcome. Greetings and gratitude to everyone tuning in. My name is Michael Deem, and I will be your host for this show, this episode of Bards Rise. Before we begin, like last week, I just want to give a couple shout-outs to my friends and family, Sunshine and Robin. They also have their own show on Saturdays from 2 to 3. They alternate weekends. And this weekend, Robin is going to have as guests both Q and me. I recommend you tune in because I have some great questions lined up for Q. And hopefully, I'm putting the intention out there, there will be a special guest mermaid for at least one of the questions that I want to ask, because she was the inspiration for the question. So we'll see what happens. Also, Lauren and Zosia, thank you. They have two shows. They're such dynamite on Saturdays as well, 11 to 12 and 4 to 5. And all these times are central. Lauren is the one with the incredible sexy voice, in my humble opinion, AKA Marilyn. You might have remembered that she was singing that song, I Want to Make Love to You, and she was singing it to Q, and I told her, so no secrets here. And just like I told her, Q has plenty of women, and he's got the mermaid, so Lauren, make love to me. Kelly, my dear friend Kelly, greetings, and I also want to thank Cindy Silva. I left her out last week. I'm so sorry, Cindy. She was instrumental in me stepping forward and doing this show. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you to all of you and others as well. So last week I told you this week was going to be about the unconstitutionality of the New York State court system, if not the entire government. I'm going to call this show Tyranny by definition. So, a little history. Our founding fathers relied heavily on a couple of historians and political philosophers. One of those people was a French judge, political philosopher, and historian by Montesquieu. He has other names. I think he has like six or seven other names, but everybody just recognizes him now by Montesquieu. He lived from 1689 through 1755. And one of his quotes is regarding tyranny is, there is no greater tyranny than that which is perpetrated under the shield of law and in the name of justice. Kind of like what Ronald Reagan used to say, hey, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Worst words you can ever hear, right? And we saw that. We lived through that a couple years ago, still recovering from that, from the jab, right? It's for your health. It's for your good. No, thank you. So tyranny. One of our founding fathers had a couple things to say about tyranny. Thomas Jefferson. Tyranny is defined as that which is legal for the government, but illegal for the citizenry. Another comment. I have sworn on the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. I'm sorry, Thomas Jefferson. Again, Thomas Jefferson. When injustice becomes law, resistance becomes duty. And resistance doesn't necessarily have to be violence. It could be voting at the ballot box or standing up and petitioning your elected officials, organizing, forming action committees, and getting others to join in your cause. And that's what I am here to advocate for. And finally, another quote by Thomas Jefferson, all tyranny needs to gain a foothold is for good people of good conscience to remain silent. And that is specifically what I want to address through this show. I want people to stand and rise and push back against this system. And not just here in the United States. This goes across the world. Everybody should be doing this. Everybody should be pushing back against tyranny and oppression by government. And if for some reason your country doesn't have a mechanism to do that, reach out to other countries. not the UN. They're the problem, right? But somewhere out there, just put the intention out there. And in fact, I'll recommend to you something that was recommended to me, and I have used it, not just by myself, but with others. And we have had tremendous results. Specifically when one of my dear friends was being attacked and she felt the results instantly. So you put out the intergalactic distress call, and that is Q. And at the end of that third Q, you, whether you can sense them or not, will have beings of immense abilities with you. And then all you have to do is explain the situation that you want to resolve, perhaps do a command about it, and it will be done. Again, I did that just a few days ago, and I had immediate results, not for me, but by somebody else who blurted out, "I felt that." So it works. Okay, so why this concern on tyranny? I mean, some people say that we've been in existence for 250 years now. That was something of the past, something that we've already conquered, something that our forefathers, our founding fathers, put to rest. No, unfortunately, that is not the case at all. I recently saw a video with Joe Rogan. He was interviewing somebody, and he actually said evil is real. And they're talking about how real evil with a capital E exists in this world to this day. And it has for thousands of years. And we need to acknowledge that. And we need to understand that. And if you're evil and you're trying to control people, what's the best way to do that? Infiltrate the government. Another problem we have is Freemasonry. I mentioned them last week, and I'll mention them again this week. Whenever you talk about corruption and evil, you have to mention Freemasonry because that is its foundation. And then finally, Jordan Maxwell, in another interview, he talks about how the entire legal system is based on the law of water, maritime law, because that's where the pirates operate. And they don't want us to know that. But if you look at the United States high watermark, it's something like up in the mountains, because they redefine what is maritime so that they can control the land as well. It's what they do, right? They lie, hide, obfuscate, try to control everything. Recently, President Trump has been dealing with some of this evil and tyranny with three specific district court judges. We have James Boasberg, Theodore Chang, I'm not sure how you pronounce the word. He's in the U.S. District of Maryland. And then Paul Engelmeyer, U.S. District Judge in the Southern District of New York. Each of them have made outlandish rulings on his executive actions. And I, for one, was absolutely outraged, right, because I have a legal background. And I couldn't help but think to myself, who the fuck is this rinky-dink U.S. District Court judge in some little district in the middle of the United States? Where do they get off saying that they have the same authority as the elected president, executive of the entire country? In fact, what we're going to get into is a little bit in the Constitution. They're not even mentioned in the Constitution. They are in an Article 3 court. They didn't exist at the time of the Constitution and the founding of this country. They were created later. So if you want to buy into this make-believe three co-equal branches of government bullshit, they're not it. the Supreme Court as a whole maybe could be considered co-equal to the other two branches, but certainly not some rinky-dink little district judge that's really sitting in a maritime courtroom. Where do they get off? So finally, some people are starting to come out there and make different recommendations on what can be done about this, these absurd decisions coming out from the district courts. One of them is Michael Savage, and he resonates with me, and I encourage you to listen to him and check him out. If he resonates with you, great. If not, that's great too. But he, for me, is a source of reason. Somebody else who's commented on this on the YouTube show Redacted, who, by the way, I love the two hosts, but they, about a month ago, interviewed Lionel. He's a radio show host on Lionel Nation. He has his own radio show and, you know, a big legal background. But I was listening to him, and the video that I first saw basically said that you can't do anything about these district judges, about these rulings, because they have such a wide margin in which to make their decisions, you can't really do anything. And he brought up the decision of Dred Scott, right, where the U.S. Supreme Court held that slaves were property. Blacks, African Americans, they were property and they can be owned. Believe it or not, that decision never has been overturned. But, well, not by a court, but the Civil War sure overturned it. So there is something that can be done. He is dead wrong when he says that nothing can be done. What else can be done? We don't have to go through to those extents, that measure. One of the people who commented recently is Ron DeSantis. Ron DeSantis very accurately said we can strip those courts of that jurisdiction, so they can't even entertain those types of lawsuits brought by these enemies of the state, these liberal activists stepping in front of their friends, right? So we can eliminate their jurisdiction because they're Article III courts. It absolutely is fair game. What else can we do? Well, there was one commentator said that we can impeach the district judge. Here, I'm looking at an excerpt from the Charlie Kirk show. He was talking about impeaching the judges, which is absolutely fine, too. I mean, that's right in the sweet spot of something that you can do. They don't have the authority to get involved in executive actions. You know, well, what's the difference based on that judge's ruling or those rulings from those judges and others that I mentioned? If you were to follow that decision, then what's the difference between what a judge does and what the president does? Nothing. Nothing. So clearly, they're way overbounds. They are out of their lane, and they need to be put back in their box and not gently, and send a message to every other jurist out there that you need to stay in your lane. You have been out of your lanes for far too long, and it needs to be corrected. That's recent events aside, but what's the foundation? Where does this all come from? I mean, it never was like this, right? If you look at history and some of the comments now, including the, I believe, deputy chief of staff, Mr. Miller, he talks about how this is a fairly recent phenomenon with these activist judges. Restraint, judicial restraint, used to be orthodoxy within the federal courts. Certainly not anymore. So I thought of this one case where it all came for me, where it started. And I remember what Q teaches us, right? The bad guys, the aliens, the ones that don't use their heart center or perhaps don't even have a heart, they're in this for the long game. They're looking at a 2,000-year war, 4,000-year war. So the founding of this country, we're going to go to the landmark case of Marbury versus Madison. It's absolutely bedrock case. Every single law student that has ever existed has read and learned about this case. You're welcome to try and read it yourself. I guarantee you, if you're just the average person or even a really smart person and you don't have some type of, you know, advanced genetics or alien enhancements or whatever it is, you're going to have to read that case more than once. It took me 8 times before I finally understood what they were talking about. It's really thick stuff. So instead, I recommend you go to Wikipedia or some other, you know, source that summarizes everything for you in modern day plain English. It'll be much easier. But I just want to set the stage and let you know what's really underlying, in my opinion, a lot of this. Okay, so the background of that case, Marbury versus Madison, is this. In the fiercely contested U.S. presidential election of 1800, the three main candidates were Thomas Jefferson, Aaron Burr, and the incumbent president, John Adams. Adams espoused the pro-business and pro-national government politics of the Federalist Party and its leader, Alexander Hamilton. Jefferson and Burr were leaders of the opposition Democratic Tack Republican Party, which favored agriculture and decentralization. American public opinion had gradually turned against the Federalists, which would have been Adams, in the months leading up to the election. The shift was mainly due to the Federalists' use of the controversial Alien and Seditions Act, but also due to growing tensions with Great Britain, with whom the Federalists favored close ties. Stop. Great Britain. The Federalists, or John Adams, favored close ties with Great Britain, the Queen, back then the King, the Lizard, the Draconian, right? The Draconian Empire. So if you want to get in bed with those, you're really not our friends. So John Adams, in with England. And I continue. Jefferson easily won the election's popular vote, but only narrowly defeated Adams in the Electoral College. After the results of the election became clear, Adams and the Federalists became determined to exercise their remaining influence before Jefferson took office. And they did everything they could to fill federal offices with anti-Jeffersonians who were loyal to the Federalists, i.e., buddies of England. Who does that sound like in modern times? The Democrats, right? Biden was on his way out. What do? They sign all these crazy contracts. They try and pack as many positions as they can in government to help themselves and their buddies and to try and thwart Donald Trump. History repeats itself. On March 2nd, 1801, just 2 days before his presidential term ended, Adams nominated nearly 60 Federalist supporters to new circuit judge and justice of the peace positions the Federalist-controlled Congress had recently created. These last-minute nominees, whom Jefferson supporters derisively called the Midnight Judges, including William Marbury, a prosperous businessman from Maryland. An ardent Federalist, Marbury was active in Maryland politics and had been a vigorous supporter of the Adams presidency. And it goes on to explain how Marbury didn't actually get his commission. It took too long because they only had 2 days before Adams was out of office and they couldn't actually deliver the commission to him. And now that the new president was in power, Jefferson, he refused to do it. He's like, no way, you're not good for the country. You're not working for me. Kind of like what Donald Trump is trying to do, right? I want my team in here, not somebody else's, to try and undermine me. So Marbury sued. He brought a suit, hence Marbury versus Madison. And now I'm going to fast forward to the legal criticism. The Supreme Court's historic decision in Marbury versus Madison continues to be the subject of critical analysis and inquiry. In a 1955 Harvard Law Review article, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, whom I believe was the predecessor. I mean, he's if you read his decisions, at least to me, they are very, very similar in how they're written, the mentality, the philosophy, the style to Antonin Scalia. And I can't think of a single decision that I read from Antonin Scalia that I disagreed with. So I'd recommend you go and read that article if you're interested in this stuff. So Frankfurter emphasized that one can criticize Marshall's opinion in Marbury without demeaning it. The courage of Marbury, in quotes, the courage of Marbury versus Madison is not minimized by suggesting that its reasoning is not impeccable and its conclusion, however wise, not inevitable. In other words, really, it doesn't make sense, right? When you read a court's decision, it should make sense and it should be on point. And that's not what Frankfurter says. An absolutely brilliant, brilliant legal mind. So criticisms of Marshall's opinion in Marbury usually fall into two general categories. First, some criticize the way Marshall strove to reach the conclusion that the U.S. Supreme Court has constitutional authority over the other branches of the U.S. government. In other words, if you go and read the U.S. Constitution, it doesn't say anything, not bupkis, about three co-equal branches of government. It just lists the responsibilities that each one is going to do. And the weakest of those three, from the legislative to the executive to the judiciary, is the judiciary, because they only have the authority to pass judgment. The courts that we see today are a far cry from what there used to be in this court or in this country. One example, here's a perfect example, trial by jury versus a jury trial. Here in New York State, our Constitution guarantees to us a jury trial, just like the federal Constitution. However, what we get is a, quote, trial by jury. At common law, we had a right to a jury trial, which means that the jury of our peers determined not only the facts, but what the law was. And the judge was pretty much just like a stenographer. He's taking notes. The people were doing both. But nowadays, the judge instructs the jury on what the law is. They took that out of their hands, even though it's written in the Constitution. They don't give it to us. And when I asked for mine at trial, the judge didn't know what to do. One day, maybe I'll read that transcript to you. It's an absolute joke. We are getting hosed left and right. I can't wait for our fundamental rights to be returned to us. So to continue where I left off, right, the Constitution doesn't say anything about co-equal branches of government. But today, American courts generally follow the principle of constitutional avoidance. In other words, if the case can be decided without reaching a question about the Constitution and an interpretation of the Constitution, then you do that, right? Because why? I mean, that should be the last resort. And overall, if that's the approach, that's fine. But there's too many other things that get in the way that deprive us of the rights that are provided for in the Constitution. So in that sense, I have some objections to it. And I just gave you a perfect example. Jury trial versus trial by jury. Okay. And then I'm going to skip a few lines here. Second, the second big critique is Marshall's arguments for the court's authority are sometimes said to be mere series of assertions rather than substantive reasons logically laid out to support his position. Scholars generally agree that Marshall's series of assertions regarding the U.S. Constitution and the actions of the other branches of government do not, quote, inexorably lead to the conclusion that Marshall draws from them. In other words, he was trying to fit a round peg into a square hole or vice versa. It just doesn't work. And that's because, and I'll say it, He was an activist. And why was he an activist? Well, look at who's being an activist these days. The Democrats, right? The ones who want to buddy up with the hybrids, the bloodlines, the ones that are tied inextricably to England and the Queen and that whole disgusting empire. Here we go. It all started with this. So if we were to get the U.S. Supreme Court to reevaluate this decision, Marbury versus Madison, a lot of things would change. But do you think they're going to do that? Do you think that they're going to say, okay, we're going to give up our power? You know, right now we're a co-equal branch of government, just like the others. We will voluntarily step down. Good luck. But what we can do is amend the Constitution and specifically put in there that the U.S. Supreme Court is not a co-equal branch of government, that the U.S. Supreme Court does not have the final decision on the interpretation of the U.S. Constitution. All of that is perfectly legitimate. Absolutely. So there are other options besides stripping the Article III courts of jurisdiction. We can eliminate the Article III courts altogether. We don't need them. Right? Especially once the reevaluation, the golden age ushers in. Why do we need to go to court to fight over a few dollars? Everybody's going to have everything, plenty. So why do we need them? Just something else to think about. So back to tyranny, because this is where it all starts, right? I showed you one example of the first instance of them trying to usurp power to themselves and to the courts. And to try and hide it, right? Who would have ever thought that the courts could be the worst, one of the worst enemies that we can have? Certainly one of the worst domestic enemies within this country and at every level. Same issues at the state level, same issues at the local levels. Courts are absolutely tyrannical. Why? So I keep throwing around that word, tyrannical and tyranny. Let's get into what James Madison, Federalist number 47, said about tyranny. Skipping a few paragraphs, going down, no political truth is certainly of greater intrinsic value or is stamped with the authority of more enlightened patrons of liberty than that on which the objection is founded. The accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judiciary, in the same hands, whether of one, a few, or many, and whether hereditary, self-appointed, or elective, may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny. And there you have it. The combination of any one or all of those three different branches of government in any one person or body is by definition tyranny. Skipping a few more paragraphs, from these facts by which Montesquieu was guided, it may be clearly inferred that in saying, quote, there can be no liberty where the legislative and executive powers are united in the same person or body of magistrates. Or, quote, if the power of judging be not separated from the legislative and executive powers. He did not mean that these departments ought to have no partial agency in or no control over the acts of each other. His meaning, as his own words import, and still more conclusively as illustrated by the example in his eye, can amount to no more than this, that where the whole power of one department is exercised by the same hands which possess the whole power of another department, the fundamental principles of a free constitution are subverted. There you have it. The whole power of one department is exercised with the whole power of another. So now let's skip to the Federalist number 78. This was Alexander Hamilton writing as Publius, his pen name. Again, skipping a few paragraphs. Whoever attentively considers the different departments of power must perceive that in a government in which they are separated from each other, the judiciary, from the nature of its functions, will always be the least dangerous to the political rights of the Constitution, because it will be least in a capacity to annoy or injure them. Yeah, go tell that to somebody who was ever fined $100 or whatever by a judge, or given a restraining order by a judge. The executive not only dispenses the honors, but holds the sword of the community. The legislature not only commands the purse, but prescribes the rules by which the duties and rights of every citizen are to be regulated. The judiciary, on the contrary, has no influence over either the sword or the purse. Really? They're the ones who put you in jail. They're the ones who fine you. They're the ones who tell to take your kids away from you. No direction either of the strength or of the wealth of the society, and can take no active resolution whatever. Really? Oh boy, the last 250 years have not served this passage well. It's not aged well at all. It may truly be said to have neither force nor will. This is what Hamilton is saying about the courts. Really? The courts do not have force or will? But merely judgment, and must ultimately depend upon the aid of the executive arm, even for the efficacy of its judgments. The courts didn't have authority to enforce their own judgments, at least not in the eyes of Hamilton. And to my knowledge, not a single founding father ever objected to his understanding of what the judiciary branch could or could not do. Again, skipping a few lines, for I agree that, quote, there is no liberty if the power of judging be not separated from the legislative and executive powers. Seems like he too is quoting Montesquieu. And it proves in the last place that as liberty can have nothing to fear from the judiciary alone, but would have everything to fear from its union with either of the other departments. Okay, so there you have it. Same thing with respect to the definition of tyranny. If one branch of government exercises the authority, the whole authority of another branch of government, or perhaps all three of them, then by definition, that is tyranny. And now, I'd like to read to you the U.S. Constitution, Article 4, Section 4. The United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government. Now, if you were to go to a lawyer or a judge and cite this passage to them, they'd say, oh, no, that passage, that provision in the U.S. Constitution is not enforceable. It just can't be enforced because there's so many different varieties or types of government that can constitute a republican form of government. Who is the court to say that one is right and one is wrong? Now, objectively, up until a few years, until I was involved in my divorce and custody and criminal proceedings, I would have agreed with that. But I think it's fair to say, and let me just be clear, the U.S. Supreme Court has held several times that this provision of the Constitution is not enforceable for those reasons. However, I think it's fair to say, and courts have also held this, that every single provision of a statute should be given meaning. You can't just say this makes no sense, right? And the Supreme Court has held that as well. Well, if we do that for statutes, then why don't we do that for the Constitution? Instead of saying that this paragraph is this provision in Section 4 of the Guarantee Clause, it's called, instead of saying that that's unenforceable, why don't you just say that on the facts of this case, it is not enforceable, or that this case, the facts of this case, do not meet the standard in this provision of the Constitution, instead of closing the door and saying you can never enforce this. Because I'm about to give you an example where it absolutely applies. And before I do that, I think it's also fair to say that regardless of the type of form of government that you envision under the umbrella of Republican form of government, I think there is one form of government that we can all agree would not qualify for protection under the U.S. Constitution. And that would be a tyranny, right? I mean, that's why we had a civil war, or I'm sorry, a revolution, to get away from tyranny. That's why we had a constitutional convention, to come up with papers to ensure we don't get back into a tyranny, either now, immediately, or somewhere down the road. So tyranny can never be a Republican form of government. So if somebody can prove that their form of government, at whatever level of government you're talking about, then that would qualify for protection under the federal Constitution. And now, call your attention to the New York State Constitution, the one that was amended as of 2001. And I believe if you look for it on the internet, the most recent date is 2022. So, Article 6, Judiciary, Section 28. The Chief Judge of the Court of Appeal shall be the Chief Judge of the State of New York and shall be the Chief Judicial Officer of the Unified Court System. Makes sense? There shall be an Administrative Board of the Courts, which shall consist of the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals as Chairperson and the Presiding Justice of the Appellate Division of the Supreme Court of each Judicial Department. There are four Judicial Departments. So that means that the Chief Judge and the four presiding judges from the intermediate appellate courts, they are the administrative board of the courts. So they're running themselves. Okay. The chief judge shall, with the advice and consent of the administrative board of the courts, appoint a chief administrator of the courts who shall serve at the pleasure of the chief judge. So they're going to get some poke to run around and take care of the day-to-day stuff. Clearly, what we have here is a delineation between a judge's judicial duties in determining specific cases or reviewing specific cases and the facts and law in those cases, and running a bureaucracy. Okay? Running a bureaucracy, that's executive level stuff, right? If you were to bring it out to the whole government, it would be under the presidential authority. But here, they don't have a president. They have kind of like a mini president and a mini legislature of the court system. So they can operate independently of what's happening out there with the governor and the state legislature. Seems a little odd, but let's keep reading. Section 28B, the chief administrator, on behalf of the chief judge, shall supervise the administration and operation of the unified court system. In the exercise of such a responsibility, the chief administrator of the courts shall have such powers and duties as may be delegated to him or by the chief judge, and such additional powers and duties as may be provided by law. Okay, so there are two entities that can really give him, well, three, that can give him directions and guidance. One is the chief judge who appointed him. Two, the entire administrative board, which is the chief judge and then the four presiding judges from the other intermediate courts. And then finally, as provided by law. Well, where does that come from? Well, you would think that it would be the state legislature, right? The state legislature can tell him what to do. Makes sense. And that would be a law that was signed by the governor. Okay, that is okay. But what types of laws are we talking about here? What type of authority? Doesn't say. Okay, so continuing, 28C, The chief judge, after consultation with the administrative board, shall establish standards and administrative policies for general application throughout the state. Which shall be submitted by the chief judge to the Court of Appeals, together with the recommendations, if any, of the administrative board. Such standards and administrative policies shall be promulgated after approval by the Court of Appeals. So if the chief judge wants a rule to apply to the entire state court system, then he or she would present that to the rest of the Court of Appeals, who really work for her, and then they would decide on what to do based on advice and consent of lower judges, right, whose opinions that they review. You think they're going to pay attention to them? No, they're going to do what they want, and primarily what the chief judge probably wants to do. So what we have here is, in my humble opinion, all three branches of government being exercised by five people, at best seven people, because there are seven people on the New York Court of Appeals, not nine like the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court. Seven. So seven people are running the entire court system. They generate the rules, they exercise those rules, enforce them, and they interpret those rules. Sorry, that doesn't wash in my eyes. But let's continue and see what else the New York State Constitution says. Section 30, Article 6. The legislature shall have the same power to alter and regulate the jurisdiction and proceedings in law and in equity that it has heretofore exercised. In other words, what you had before, you can still do it now. The legislature may, on such terms as it shall provide and subject to subsequent modification, delegate in whole or in part to a court, including the appellate division of the Supreme Court or to the chief administrator of the courts, any power possessed by the legislature to regulate practice and procedures in the courts. Do you realize what just happened here? I mean, before in Section 28, it was my interpretation of what the Constitution said, that there was a commingling of different, functions of government, that the court system was exercising, the New York Court of Appeals was exercising the judicial, executive, and legislative branches of government. But here, now in Section 30, it's formal. It's formal. The legislature can delegate their authority to any court, including some that are listed, or the administrator. So we have a complete authority of that legislature being delegated to the judicial, a commingling of two functions of government. And it's the entire function of the legislative branch that's being delegated, its authority. It didn't say partial authority. No, all of its authority. That, my friends, is on its face tyranny by definition. And then you say, well, who did this? The entire New York State government did it. Because in order for the legislature to pass a law delegating its authority, it has to propose the law, go through that whole process, present it to the governor. The governor signs off, and then it becomes law, and it goes down to the judicial. So essentially, all three branches of government have accepted that. And the courts, did they reject it? No. They didn't say, oh, this is an overreach. You can't do this. We can't exercise this authority. You have to give us instructions instead of letting us determine what we want to do. They'll never do that, especially when you're dealing, as I demonstrated last week, a bunch of Masonic and satanic judges. They're witches. They engage in human sacrifice. You honestly think they're going to say, no, no. By all rights, you shouldn't be doing this. This is tyranny. No, not quite. And so they've been given this authority. And have they exercised it? Because maybe somebody will say, well, okay, Mike, this is all theory. Prove to us that they've actually exercised this authority and written rules and procedures that combine all these functions. Okay, fine. Exhibit A. In February 2006, the chief judge of the New York State, prior to February 2006, the chief judge, Judith Kaye, the Satanist that I showed you last week, had established a matrimonial commission because the divorce courts, matrimonial courts in New York, were so screwed up. So they went around, they did a study, and in February 2006, they published a report. The chairperson was Judge Sandra Miller. On page 6 of the report, that's where I'll pick up, the report says, with respect to the appointment of forensic and financial experts, the court may expressly state the issues to be evaluated by the expert, the format and content of the expert's resulting report, and the schedule for submission of the report to the court. And they're talking about the divorce court itself, right? These are things that the divorce court can do. The court, and this is the kicker, the court may also determine at this time the parameters for payment of the experts and the law guardian or attorney for the children. That term has been changed now. It's attorney for the children for their service. This may be by the parties directly through public funds or some combination of these. The commission recognizes that the appointment and payment process varies widely from court to court and across judicial districts and departments. And then there's a footnote. To the extent possible, the commission strives to respect these local practices in crafting its recommendations. So they're just piling on top of the problem. They're not going to the root problem of this. The fact that they say that the practice varies widely from court to court is outrageous to me anyway, because we're talking about fundamental constitutional rights. We're talking about free speech. We're talking about religious exercise. We're talking about parental rights. We're talking about Second Amendment rights. And that varies from court to court. Are you out of your mind? And the New York Court of Appeals knows about this, and they haven't stepped in to make things uniform. Say, no, you need to bring it up to the level, the bare minimum that's been established by the U.S. Supreme Court. No, they couldn't care less what federal law says. New York does what New York wants to do when it comes to divorce and child custody proceedings. In another case, I'll show you how New York State has a peonage system. Absolutely, a child peonage system through its divorce and family courts. But I want to drop down here to give you a little more detail on this, on the footnote that was dropped, right? So it says the first and second departments, which is basically New York City, about the southern half of New York State is the first. The first department is all of Manhattan. The second department is the rest of the southern New York, excluding Manhattan. So the first and second departments permit the discretionary practice of directing parents with sufficient means to pay the attorney for the children's fee in both Supreme Court and family court. What are you kidding me? Listen to that. If that judge happens to think that you have enough money, they can order you under threat of imprisonment to pay the attorney for the children and other experts in the case. And what experts? What the judge determines is needed in the case. And here's a kicker. The judge determines how much that you're going to pay them, the hourly rate. And then that individual, well, he determines how many hours he puts in the case. And this amounts to literally tens of thousands of dollars. In fact, there's a rule out there that says if you made over, I think it's $120,000 in 1 year, well, then you can't get any appointments for the next year. Unless, of course, it's for the same case and it's really important, then the judge can sign a waiver and you can keep raking in the bucks because you landed a whale and you could just keep billing. This is absolutely outrageous. Read the U.S. Supreme Court's decisions on paying for speech, being compelled to pay for speech that you disagree with, let alone that are against your interests. This country was founded on an adversarial system of law. In other words, the best way to get to the truth is to give two people equal footing and say, okay, you two beat it out. Show me everything you have, all the dirt, give it to me. I'm the judge, and then I'll decide what the truth is, right? I'll come up with a reasonable decision. No, that's not what happens here in the New York court system. The court decides that it's going to engage in an inquisitorial system of law. They're going to get their people that you have to talk to, and they're going to tell me what your secrets are, what you don't want me to know, because they work for me. I mean, after all, I'm paying them, right? You're flipping the bill, but I tell them how much. This is absolutely insane and cannot stand up to the U.S. Supreme Court's precedents on free speech and compelled payment of speech that we disagree with. It's absolutely insane. And when you trace back the sources of these rules and what allows the court to do this, you'll come up with two authorities. One is the New York State Judiciary Law, Section 35, Subsection 3. That provision deals with indigent, with appointment of counsel for indigents, people that cannot pay. But somehow, this corrupt court twisted the rules. And by the way, these two courts combined, first and second, control nearly, I'd say, 70% of the population of New York State and about 50% of the landmass of New York State. So really, this is, for all intents and purposes, all of New York. You'll find their decision, right, which isn't supported by the law at all. And in a subsequent case, they cite the New York Court of Appeals, or perhaps it's that second, it escapes me, but they reference one of the rules that was made by the chief judge. So the chief judges wrote the rule that you have to pay according to them and how much, or they'll put you in jail. They enforce that rule and they interpret that rule, which violates, like I said, myriad fundamental constitutional rights. Folks in New York, you are in an absolute tyranny by definition. Real quick, the Fourth Department permits parental payment of law guardians in Supreme Court, but does not permit parental payment in the family court. That doesn't make sense. I mean, it should be all be one rule, right? And then the Third Department has held that law guardians or attorneys for the children shall be paid by the state and does not recognize parental payment as an option in any Supreme Court or family court proceedings. The Third Department has also held that there is no statutory or regulatory authority for payment for an attorney for the children by a parent, and that the lack of parameters for a direct pay system raises issues about the independence of the law guardian, attorney for the children, and concerns about fundamental fairness to all children. There you have it. Finally, one of the departments had the moral clarity and intestinal fortitude to say the right thing, that you guys are just making it up. Put another way, the First, Second, and Fourth Departments are stealing money from the average citizens, from families that are in distress and on the verge of breakup. It is absolute tyranny. Everything that was cautioned against in the Federalist Papers 47 and 78 and by Montesquieu and Thomas Jefferson, it's all come to fruition. So it shouldn't be a surprise when you see these district court judges doing the same thing at the federal level. Thank you for listening, folks. I truly, truly hope that this has helped you. If you know anyone in these circumstances, please send them this video. or direct them to this station, and hopefully we can help them and change this. Reach out to your elected officials at the federal office, especially the FBI and the Department of Justice. File complaints, because we have criminals in the New York State court system that are stealing our money, stealing our children, trampling our fundamental rights, which violates U.S. Code Title 18, Sections 241 and 242. Thank you, thank you, thank you for joining me. I look forward to speaking with you again next week. Whoa!